This is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 in Chico. I'm Diane Suzuki, sitting in for Susan and Stephen Trudy tonight. With us tonight are Joel Salatin, farmer, lecturer, and author of You Can Farm and Salad Bar Beef. His most recent book is Folks, This Ain't Normal. Also joining us will be Chris Kirsten from Chaffin Farm Orchards and Chita Chudy, organic farmer and rancher. We'll take a short break and be back to talk with Joel, Chris, and Chita.
Row by row, gonna make this garden grow. Gonna mulch it deep and low, gonna make it fertile ground. Inch by inch, row by row, please bless these seeds I sow. Please keep them safely low till the rain comes tumbling down. Pulling weeds, picking stone, we are made of dreams and bone. Need a place to call my own, cause the time is close at hand.
Rain by rain, sun and rain, find myself in nature's chain. Tune the body and my brain to the music of the land.
Join us now. Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. Gonna mulch it deep and low, gonna make it fertile ground. Inch by inch, row by row, please bless these seeds I sow. Please keep them safe below till the rain comes tumbling down.
Plant your rows straight and long, sitting with a prayer and song. Mother Earth will make you strong if you give her loving care.
Old crow watching from a tree, got his hungry eye on me. In my garden I'm as free as a feathered thief up there. Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. Gonna mulch it deep and low, gonna make it fertile ground. Inch by inch, row by row, please bless these seeds I sow. Please keep them safe below till the rain comes tumbling down.
You can ask him. Maybe it's because you don't like gardening. But the last verse is especially for you.
Slug by slug, weed by weed, boy, this garden's got me cheap. All the insects come to feed.
Ecotopia is made possible in part by member contributions and by EcoCab, Chico's green alternative taxi service. EcoCab provides safe, reliable transportation 24 hours a day and a new fuel-efficient Toyota Prius. Protect the planet and get to where you need to be with EcoCab, the cab that cares. Call 591-3186. And by Chico Green Builders, providing healthy and sustainable homes for the greater Chico community for over 20 years. For new construction and remodeling, you can reach Robin Trenda by calling him at 342-8267 or email him at chicogreenbuilders, all one word, at att.net. With us on the phone is Joel Salatin, organic, sustainable farmer, lecturer, inventor of innovative land restoration and soil building techniques, activist for sustainable living, and founder and owner of Polyface Farm in Swoop, Virginia. You may know him from having been featured in Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, or from the films Food, Inc. and Fresh. His previous books include You Can Farm and Salad Bar Beef. His newest book is Folks, This Ain't Normal. He's here to talk about that book, his work, and his upcoming talk in Chico on Monday, April 16th. Joining us in the studio also are Chris Kirsten, farm manager of Chaffin Family Orchards, and Chita Chudy, organic farmer, manager, and rancher. Welcome, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be with you.
All right. Okay, we're all here. Great.
So, Joel, on behalf of my parents who invited you here to speak with us today and myself, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show tonight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
Diving right in, the book, it's Folks, This Ain't Normal. What direction in terms of audience were you looking at? Who are you hoping will read this book?
Everybody. There's enough in there to make everybody happy and everybody mad.
It concerns a refrain of many, many things that ain't normal. And not only in the world of farming and agriculture, but everything from government regulations to packing. Could you start by setting out a few of the abnormalities in your mind and how we are doing things wrong?
Oh, well, I wrote the book because I do a lot of speaking and traveling, and I've really started speaking at a lot of colleges, seeing a lot of young people, I love young people, they're the future. But a lot of people under 50, I call those young people, well, let's say under 40, it seems almost like they are living in a kind of a daze in which they really believe that we're going to be able to sail off into some Star Trek future eating a breakfast pill and extricating ourselves once and for all from this mundane task of visceral living, you know, the things where we had you know, visceral relationships with actually living skills. So, you know, we're the first civilization in history that routinely has no chores for children. That has huge ramifications, health and, you know, self-awareness. We're the first civilization that has had cheap energy. You know, nobody has ever had cheap energy before, who routinely eats unpronounceable food or food that won't rot. The first generation in which we have a huge bureaucratic food police that tells us it's perfectly safe to feed your kids Twinkies, Cocoa Puffs, and Mountain Dew, but raw milk, compost-grown tomatoes, pastured poultry, and Aunt Matilda's pickles are hazardous substances. So yeah, there are a lot of things that are a little bit out of whack here, and so the book is written to try to put all of this in context, help everybody understand. The way to bet for the future is that many of these normalities, the glues that have held civilizations together, we will be returning to in the future if energy gets more expensive, if health issues drive us to, you know, more personal health awareness, if food becomes expensive and we begin having to grow some of it ourselves on our own patios and our rooftops and then our lawns, perish the thought, you know, edible landscaping. And so it's a wake-up call, but it's also a very empowering book that, yes, you know, here are the lifelines. I throw them out. Here are the lifelines you can get a hold of to know that in the future you're not a guinea pig aberrant behavior. You're actually holding on to things that have held civilizations together for a long, long time.
So, Joel, what does that transition look like to more expensive energy? As energy prices go up, how do we transition to a system that's more self-sustaining and bring society along with that?
Well, there are several ways. One is, obviously, the food system is going to have to become more localized. We simply can't be shipping this much water this far around the country, especially, you know, fruit and vegetables. Yes, nutrient density, like, you know, heavy cheese or nutrient dense things like meat, those can be shipped farther, certainly, but historically fruits and, you know, vegetables, except for things like citrus and specialty things, olives, were not shipped very far. And so it's going to be a more localized system. It'll mean that our farms are going to be more diversified. That means they're not going to be single crops or single species. They're going to have both plants and animals, and in many cases, animals are going to be doing some work. I mean, I still, everywhere I go, I talk about how I was mesmerized out at Chaffin Family Orchards by watching the goat herd climb up in those ancient olive trees and prune the suckers off of those olives and mow under the olive orchard, you know, instead of using expensive machinery or human labor, actually letting animals use their, you know, their goatiness as an integral relationship with the production model. So, you know, diversification, localization, relational-oriented farms, you know, there's going to be, and I think there just needs to be more farmers. I mean, we're the first, talk about aberration, you know, our culture now has twice as many people incarcerated in prisons as we have farming, stewarding our air, soil, and water. I would suggest that air, soil, and water cannot be stewarded when you have that few eyes and ears and warm bodies on the landscape.
Absolutely.
Beautifully spoken. Well, on this show, there's a recurrent question of how can this change come about? What can be done on the individual level? And in your opinion, is it going to be individual effort? Is it activism in organisms, groups of people? Is it through revolution? How can we hope that the government will do anything or will otherwise block efforts for change?
Well, I think the change is going to happen just like the current change, you know, just like the current aberrant behavior we're in. Whatever you like or don't like about our culture, the truth is that it is indeed a manifestation of billions and billions and billions of individual decisions that have stacked up over time. You know, the decisions to, for example, put our faith in multinational corporate food conglomerates rather than our local food sources, the decisions to confine animals in factory houses rather than allow them to gambol in pasture, in symbiotic, synergistic, interrelational networks. You know, those are all very, you know, the decision to, to have cheap food rather than nutrient-dense or high-quality food. Where we are the result of these decisions. And so I would suggest that where we're going to be in 10, 20, 30 years, whatever, wherever we're headed, will also be the result of many, many numerous decisions. And so, you know, what I promote is we need to realize that we have to participate. We can't have an integrity food and farming and landscape stewardship culture in which so few of the people are participating in it. We don't have a crisis of resource. We don't have a crisis of economy. We don't have a crisis of innovation. We have a crisis of participation.
On that note, I'd like to seize this opportunity to ask Chris a question here. Just curious to hear more, as a friend, about your origins in farming, how Joel Salatin's writings and speaking has influenced your development.
So I started farming a little over 10 years ago. I met the woman who became my wife in high school, and her family had a ranch, and I fell in love with the lifestyle. I fell in love with the simplicity of the animals, the grass, the sunshine, seeing it all work together. But was part of a pretty conventional model, and that was the world I was a part of. That was the world I defended. And then I still remember the moment vividly. I was at my local public library and pulled off the shelf a copy of You Can Farm, and it was like glistening beams of sunlight were shining upon it, and angels were singing. And I picked this book up, and I read it cover to cover in about a day and a half, and it was everything that in my mind I had thought was possible, but didn't see any farmers currently doing in my sphere of influence. And so it was very empowering for me to read Joel's words and everything that that he had put down there of what could be done when you start integrating symbiotic enterprises together. And so About 6 months after that, he spoke in Lincoln at the Plaster Grown Conference, and I got to meet him. And the whole thing changed my entire outlook. So at the time, I was very involved in conventional cow-calf operations, and at that point, my wife and I said, we're going to do this different. We're going to go find somewhere that that's doing something like this. And at the time, I had just started Chico State, and I ran into Kurt and Carol Albrecht at a conference who owned Chaffin Family Orchards, which has been right here in Butte County for 100 years. It's a 2,000-acre farm. It's got grass-fed livestock, orchards. The orchards, it's 50-year-old stone fruits, 50-year-old citrus, and then the largest old-growth planting of olives in North America. So it's a really special place. So I met them, learned about what they were doing, and they told me, they said, we integrate our livestock into the orchards. The sheep and the cows do all the mowing. The goats prune, handle invasive weeds, clear riparian areas. The chickens debug and fertilize. We use about 85% less fuel than we used to. Blew my mind away. And I thought, okay, I've found kind of the California version of what Joel was talking about. And so I started working with them. I've been there 4 years. I'm now actually a farming partner on the farm. I'm also the director of marketing because that's what my degree's in. And Joel was the absolute linchpin to me making that shift and that change in my career path and my style of thinking. From then on, I've been extremely interested in natural systems, permaculture, and wherever possible, mimicking nature. So, yeah, that's kind of my background with it.
And I'd like to seize a moment to chortle a word of praise for Mr. Salatin's writing. The way it's put together, both practicality and kind of a feeling and nuance. 10 years ago, I picked up Pasture Poultry Profits and went from being a vegan and working on a veggie farm to doing a state-inspected facility within a few years. And so, indeed, the book has done worlds for us here, and just want to thank you.
Thank you.
Could I chime in? I just wanted to backtrack to Chris's mentioning of the biomimicry. Could we talk a little bit about that, Joel?
Sure.
And would you explain to the listeners what that term means?
Well, biomimicry means that what we're doing is we're looking at nature for patterns, for just essentially as a template in which we cut around this pattern, if you will, like you would a piece of cloth, and we look at nature and we take that pattern and we say, okay, so how do we duplicate that on a commercial domestic farm, a production model? And so, you know, what we see, I mean, there are just oodles of these. I mean, first of all, there is no animal-less ecology. There is no place in the earth that has no animals. So we say, well, what's the role of animals? One of the fundamental roles of animals is to move fertility that gravitates downhill and move it back uphill. And, of course, the predator-prey relationship with herbivores in nature ensure that the animals tend to sleep, bed down, and defecate on the tops of hills. So you have this wonderful pattern of herbivore perennial and fertility cycling going on, which is, you know, the secret of soil health, soil building, and maintaining the fertility flow in the undulating terrain of nature. That's one. Another one is that nature builds soil primarily with perennials. Nature doesn't till, doesn't do much tillage. And so the more we can... The less tillage and the fewer annuals we grow, the better our chances of having a forgiving landscape and a soil building model, which means we're very interested in perennials rather than annuals. It's hard to not be political in this when you realize that all six of the commodities that the American government heavily subsidizes are all annuals. In direct opposition to nature's, a template. So it's that kind of mimicking. We call it biomimicry. It's that kind of mimicking these biological patterns in nature that when we can duplicate them on the farm using our technology like electric fences and hoop structures and plastic and water pipes and things like that, we can actually, as humans, bring our intellect to our ecological umbilical, to our ecological womb, and massage it into greater productive and soil-building capacity than it would otherwise have in a static state. And that, I think, is one of our foundational mandates as large brain humans.
Again, beautifully spoken. If you're just joining us, you are listening to Ecotopia here on KZFR 90.1 Chico. On the phone with us is Joel Salatin. He's a lecturer, author, and farm activist. His new book is Folks, This Ain't Normal. He'll be here in Chico next Monday, April 16th. And we have an opportunity to talk to Chris Kirsten here, who can explain some of the details of the event this coming Monday.
Yeah, so about 8 weeks ago, the Butte County Director for Environmental Health came to us and said he wanted to host an event that focused on building bridges between regulators and food growers, which if you're a food grower, that's abnormal, to say the least. And so we put together this an event where Joel could speak to regulators during the day, and then in the evening he offered to speak to the public for us as well. And so we're going to be at Neighborhood Church on April 16th. You can get tickets at Chico Natural, or if you go to KZFR's Facebook page, I put the link on there just now, so you can actually go to SalatinChico.eventbrite.com and purchase your tickets, and you can get to that link from the KZFR Facebook page, and go ahead and like them while you're there, because community radio is awesome.
Okay, stay with us, Joel, and we're going to take a quick music break.
Great.
To Ecotopia here on KZFR 90.1 Chico.
Tonight we're have on the phone with us Joel Salatin, lecturer, author, and farm activist. His newest book is Folks, This Ain't Normal. He'll be here next Monday, April 16th. And with us we have Chris Kirsten of Chaffin Family Orchards.
So Joel, we touched on a little bit kind of some of the regulatory hurdles that farmers face, but we didn't really go into any specifics. I love your book, Everything I Want to Do is Illegal, and kind of some of the challenges that farmers face and just trying to get food to the consumers that want it. Can you spell out some of the specifics that have been hurdles for you and some of the challenges we face?
They're pretty broad, and they're not all food safety issues. I think the thing that people have to understand is that when we talk about food safety regulations, which most people think we should have some food safety regulations, as they have been written and adopted so far in our country, they are extremely scale dependent. They scale up very, very well, but they don't scale down very well. And so what happens is that the regulatory climate right now is prejudicial against small operations. I think the overriding issue here is that the food regulatory bureaucracy, let's say, so far at least, maybe this will change, but so far at least, has not really equated a local, short chain of custody, transparent commerce or business transaction as being inherently, what should I say, safer, with its own checks and balances and inherent safeguards, than a nameless, faceless, long distance, globalized, opaque, no trespassing sign, label only food transaction, and to not recognize that very different relationship in food commerce is to simply put all of your faith in a food regulatory bureaucracy. Now, there are lots of remedies, from all sorts of, exemptions to empirical analysis. Pull a sample and test it. Of course, that gets problematic because the government doesn't want to pay for it.
Right.
So, the food safety advocates, the Ralph Nader, the consumer advocacy groups. Yes, we're gonna demand testing. Well, it's. If it takes a $500 test, well, that's fine if you're a Tyson, or a huge mescaline mix operation to pull a $500 test a day, that's not a big problem at all. But if you're a small operation, that's your entire income for the whole day. And so these are the kinds of things that are affecting the local food system. And then, of course, we have a lot of other issues, things like, building a house on a farm. The open space, the green open space people have locked up farmland. They don't want anybody on farmland because we all know humans on the land destroy it, and so we don't want humans on the land. And so here we are as small local farmers, and we're wanting to do on-farm. Our kind of farming takes more people because we're not substituting drugs and chemicals for management. And so we tend to spend more money on management rather than drugs and chemicals. That takes people. And so what happens is that the unintended consequences of things like conservation easements, open space requirements, and things like that end up actually militating or prejudicing management-intensive, people-oriented, diversified types of direct market farms. And so you know, and then you hit, of course, zoning requirements and building inspection permits and things like this that that also affect, you know, small-scale producers.
Yeah, I really don't think the general public has a good look at how difficult it really is, even for the greenest and most ecological of growers, just to get their product to market. And so, you know, to kind of, you know, hear you talk about that, and have you come speak to Chico about that, it's going to be big. I mean, to see what we've had the local regulators come to us and recognize that change is needed, I think is pretty powerful. So we're excited about it.
Yeah, no question. And you know, when people ask me, where's the cutting edge of the food system change occurring? There's no question. It's in the Greater Bay Area of San Francisco.
Right.
That is absolutely the most progressive food area in the entire country, and it's fitting that that even the food regulators there would recognize, boy, you know, we've got to create some wiggle room here. Or we're going to just, you know, annihilate this whole fledgling local food movement.
So there's a question that my mother had for you, and it's on a totally different note.
His mic's not up.
Okay. So there was a question that my mother had for you here, and I was going to go ahead and pose it to you. How did you settle on the name Polyface? What does it come from? What is it inspired by?
Oh, well, we wanted to be a multifaceted farm, and so the Greek prefix for many is poly, you know, polygons, a multi-sided figure. And so we said, well, we're just going to be a many-faced farm. We'll be Polyface. And it was as simple as that.
So of the innovations and understandings that you've come to over your time on the farm and what you've gone through, what do you consider your most significant or valuable in terms of things that you observed or things that you've made?
Well, I mean, probably the thing that we're most known for is the pastured poultry, the floorless field shelter that's light enough to move by hand and is extremely efficiently. One person can move with these little schooners with about 75 birds in them. One person can move about 5,000 chickens in 60 minutes. That's pretty efficient, and they're very protected from weather and from predators and things like that. So, I mean, that certainly was a big innovation. Certainly the Eggmobile was another one. One of them that's one of my favorites, of course, is the Piggerator, where we make large-scale compost instead of turning it with machinery and petroleum energy. We build our aerobic compost piles with pigs, using the plow on the end of their nose to turn all this material by throwing in some corn. The pigs then seek the corn, and that pays their salary to do all this wonderful work. And, you know, to me, that's just simply leveraging the innate pigness of the pig, allowing the pig to fully express its physiological distinctiveness. You know, that honors and respects the pigness of the pig. And and what's neat is, not only does it allow that life for the pig, it also creates wonderful compost, and it does it very, very cheaply, as opposed to using our labor or machinery or petroleum. You know, the pigs are out there doing all this work while I'm talking on the telephone.
Well, and I love the telescoping beef feeders in that system as well, that you raise the feeders as the cattle feed and it gets mulched in, and you drop in the whole corn that they can then work back through. It's not a small thing to undertake. And you do this all in, have written, what, 8 books now?
Yes, that's right.
How did you get on that path? I've read some about it in your books, but would you say for our listeners how you got on the path of being a farmer writer?
Well, look, I always had a flair for writing. Even as a little elementary school, you know, kid, I'd come home from school and just for fun, I would write little short stories here in longhand, you know. And so I've always been a bit of a storyteller and theatrical, dramatic, you know, a good storyteller, liar kind of thing. And so... it was a natural progression to just move on up into, you know, essay contests and things like that in high school and college, and always had a flair for writing, and thought that I would, but I loved the farm, wanted to be on the farm, and early on thought, well, you know, I'll go write a bestseller somewhere, and then I'll be able to retire to the farm. This was in Watergate era, Nixon and all that, and I loved journalism and investigative reporting and kind of, you know, ferreting out the news story, and so I thought, well, I'll do my Watergate, you know, I'll find my deep throat, and we'll be up and running. And as it turned out, that was not the case. We were able to save a little bit and get back to the farm, and we had enough to kind of live on for a year and figured, well, you know, we'll do that and have to go back out and work off the farm. I will. Well, you know, we never did. And so then the farm was successful. Using these principles that we've articulated from the multi-speciation, the pasture-based, perennially-based, you know, portable infrastructure, all these kinds of things, the farm became extremely successful as we direct marketed. And we were discovered by a fella up in Pennsylvania who was writing a column for Stockman Grass Farmer, which was a bankrupt magazine at the time, based down in Mississippi, owned and edited by Alan Nation. And this guy wrote a column. He came and visited, and he was so taken by the pastured poultry thing that he wrote a column about it. And Alan was so excited about it that he came up here on a train, visited us, saw what we were doing, and said, would you, you know, write a column for the magazine? And I said, well, sure, I'd be glad to. And so I began writing, and people were, you know, excited about it. And then I got asked to speak at a couple conferences, and then more and more people started, how do you do this again? How do you do this? So, you know, naively, we actually thought, you know, if we write a how-to manual on this, then they'll quit calling us on the telephone. Well, of course, you know what happened. As soon as we wrote the manual on the pastured poultry thing, well, then, of course, the phone rang off the hook, and it just... The rest is history. So it was responding to the desire, the needs of people on how to that kind of got us into this, you know, where I was able to take my flair for writing and storytelling into kind of the how to mechanism, and now it's evolved and progressed to where I've become you know, a bit of a, what should we say, an ambassador in this whole integrity, ecological, local food tsunami that's occurring. And so obviously I'm branching out into some more, you know, broader cultural stuff. But what's exciting about it is that I do, you know, I have my calluses, and I have my, you know, my dirty, greasy hands, dirt under the fingernails. And so when I do write about cultural or you know, food ecology issues, it's not coming from an academic background. It's coming from, you know, real boots on the ground, dirt under the fingernails kind of living. And I think that makes it, it resonates with people. People understand, yeah, here's a guy that didn't just research this, you know, he lives it. And that's what makes it special.
This is Diane. I have another question for you, Joel. Another term that I saw in some of your interviews was the term food shed. I was intrigued by that.
Well, a food shed is kind of a it's the idea is we talk about watersheds. You know, if you talk about hydrology at all, you look at topographical maps or you talk to any city planner or landscape architect, you know, watersheds are a big deal, you know, to know how the water moves across the landscape. And so just like watershed describes the flow of water in a given area, a food shed describes the flow of food in a given area. And generally, watersheds don't mingle. In other words, you know, you kind of have the ridges and the little springs and creeks start and move to a common source, and so there actually is some effort from some groups to actually overlay and say a food shed should be similar to the watershed. And so we use that idea that it is a kind of defined region that's serviced, that's an interconnected service that shares a climate, shares a terrain. We could even expand it and say shares a culture, shares other money. But it's a takeoff of the idea of watersheds.
Thank you.
So I'm curious, from kind of the homesteading perspective there, as well as dealing with editors, how has your life changed over the last 15 years? You've made this transition from just working the land to writing to now, as you said, being an ambassador. How does that influence you? And on that same note, I remember in one of your books talking about the segment Staying Home and just how that's influenced your life being so far from the farm.
It certainly has changed. And we try to metabolize it graciously, but disturbance does not always yield a gracious response. And so fortunately, our team has grown. We've been blessed with some wonderful, wonderful people. So, Polyface now has about 20 full-time people involved. That includes summer interns. I'm just kind of lumping everything together. This is about what it takes to run the operation. And our son Daniel and wife Sherry are here full-time on the farm and pretty much run day-to-day operations. When I come home, he gives me my list of what I'm supposed to do before I go again, and that's fine with me because I don't have to make as many decisions that way. And so we have a lot of talent. We have a lady who answers the phone full time. We have a full time delivery driver. We have a full time product inventory manager. A full time bookkeeper. So we have added to the core Salatin family here. We've added some just stellar talent to free me up to continue doing the education informational stuff and frankly the innovation things that have made Polyface a leader. I've got a list of things that I want to do here this summer that are brand new designs. We added a brand new designed turkey mobile last year, what we call it, the Gobbledygo, and it's just a fantastic design that obviously is like all of these things. They're eclectic. They evolve over time. You have this little breakthrough, that little breakthrough, this little breakthrough, and then eventually, you kind of get all the pieces together, and you have a big deal. And so this was a big deal last year that was very cheap to build. It's very lightweight, very easy, very portable. We're talking about something that's a shelter big enough for 400 turkeys that we can, in 5 minutes, pop the perch boards and the shade cloth purlins off, throw them in the back of a pickup, hook up to it, and head 55 miles an hour down the road. So, we're constantly now trying to innovate how to scale up this portable infrastructure and so that the farm is actually portable, because so many people are coming to this that don't own land, they're not independently wealthy, and what they need is to be able to place their farm enterprise on an existing land base, either as a partner or a renter or a collaborator, in a symbiotic relationship with the current farm operation. Maybe it's an orchard, maybe it's a cattle operation, maybe it's a dairy, maybe it's a vineyard. But the mother ship can't be jeopardized by these additional enterprises. And so maintaining a portable farm really, really opens up a lot of opportunities for young people and for collaborative efforts on farms that are more commonly now being operated by 60-year-old people.
Joel, I want to talk a little bit about the people that you're employing that are kind of filling some of your voids as you're away and as your business has grown over the last two decades. Where did those people come from, all these employees that you have? Are they coming from a farming background, or are they coming from somewhere else?
No, they're actually generally not coming from a farming background. We find that often it's good to not get somebody from a farming background because they don't have so much to de-learn. although the people that I have mentioned are not doing the active farming. You know, the lady that answers the phone, the product inventory, bookkeeper, things like that. But the work, the actual farm work, is being done primarily by people who really do want to farm for their livelihood, for their vocation. And those are coming out of our intern pool. And when we have a really super great intern who would like to stick around, then we try to find a place. And what we found is that good people always pay their way. Good people always pay their way. Too many farmers are scared to death of complicating their lives with other people, and it certainly does have its own its risks that way. But I'll tell you what, growing older, being surrounded by youthful, enthusiastic, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, entrepreneurial self-starters is sure better than aging, lonely by yourself and never having another pair of hands to hold a board to nail it up on a fence.
Right, and your business has gotten large enough to create jobs for these people that, in a tough economy, are having tough times finding jobs elsewhere. So that's commendable.
Yeah, absolutely. We we like to refer to ourselves as the reverse economy. our farm is taking urban money and bringing it into the rural area. And we think that actually our culture would be a lot healthier if we took a lot of that urban money and moved it into the rural sector. I think that would be a good thing. So we have a reverse rush hour and a reverse economy.
Nice.
I want to call back to your last lecture here, where you talked about incubating young farmers, and I love the sentiment and I love the phrasing. And I'd ask of you, what words do you have for young growers? How do you deal with the regulatory adversity and dealing with the daily blows and having the stamina for the next day?
Well, that is such a clearly asked by someone who has dealt with it, because other people don't even think about those kinds of things. They just think it's all, a wonderful life of sipping coffee on the veranda at 10 a.m. watching the calves gambol through the field. They don't think about going out there in a thunderstorm at 2 a.m. and trying to slip hay under some chicks that are about to drown out in the field. Mm-hmm. But so advice to young farmers, I would suggest, first of all, do an internship, do an apprenticeship, get some, and don't be quick about it. I mean, take a year or two. Money is way less important than an experience. A couple of bad decisions and you can go bankrupt. So take your time and get your self-confidence up to where you're not just timid and you really feel confident that you can go forward with it. So look for somebody to mentor you, and get some practice under your belt first. Second thing I would say is make sure you're surrounded by either volunteers or paid people, preferably volunteers if you can coerce them into it, with people who have skills that you don't have. The truth is that all of the elements that are required for a successful young farm business, all the keys to success, never, I'm going to say never, there's probably an exception somewhere, but I'm just going to say never to drive home the point, they never grow on one set of legs. you know, most excellent production farmers are not the best marketers. Most really excellent marketers are not the very best production guys or gals. Generally, the very best production people are not necessarily the best accounting or finance people. You know, lots of times the very best mechanic people, the people who are really good at mechanics and fix-it engineer types, are often not the best, you know, animal plant people. They like machines too much, and we're talking about life here, not mechanics. And so what we need to do is look in the mirror. This really came home to me a couple of years ago when one of our interns was, you know, going out on his own. He'd been with us a couple of years, and his confidence was pretty high, and he was really struggling on his own. And we were talking about this very issue, and it just struck me like an epiphany. I just looked at him and I said, "You know what? I've never been alone. I never tried to do this alone. I mean, you know, growing up, mom and dad were here, and then when Teresa and I got married, of course, and I had Teresa, and she has these wonderful accounting and skill sets, and able to leverage the garden and produce, and you know, make clothes and live frugally. I always said the best decision I ever made was, you know, marrying a woman more frugal than I am. I mean, that's a big deal. And you know, you don't want a hard keeper, you know. you want an easy keeper. And so anyway, it just struck me, I've never been alone. And as we started, mom and dad were still here. I really was doing the farm, but you know, dad was an accountant, and so I got all that wonderful financial advice, and he kept the books the first couple of years till he passed away, and taught Teresa how to do it. And so I had somebody, you know, watching my back on the finances and keeping books that meant something, that we could look at them and say, well, you know, this enterprise is making us money, this one's losing us money, and categorize everything. And I mean, we've just always had excellent farm books and good accounting, so we knew where we were financially. That's huge. And so it's been exciting to me. I just share this just for to help you understand. Our daughter has a business management degree, and she's not on the farm right now. Lives in Stanton, about, you know, 15 minutes away. Is running an artisan's consignment shop in town, and she does my PowerPoints and has a note card collection and that sort of thing. But two of our previous interns who are now full-time farming, one as a subcontractor for us and another one who leased his own farm nearby and is still growing some stuff for us but also doing a herd share dairy strictly for himself, both of these young couples starting out, they've hired our daughter Rachel. It's a very part-time job, but because they don't like the accounting and bookkeeping and balancing the checkbook, so they've hired her as their kind of bookkeeper, you know, check writer, financial person. And so here, even though they're just literally starting, I've been excited to see them go ahead and say, you know what, we don't like this, we're not good at this, so let's find somebody that's really good at it so we can concentrate on, you know, butchering chickens and growing tomatoes and milking cows and the things that we do. And that is just so valuable because young people tend to think, you know, that they hear all this about a farmer has to be a jack of all trades and be able to do all this stuff. Yeah, we do wear a lot of hats, but we don't have to wear every hat. And so so look around for what can complement your weaknesses and shore that up earlier rather than later. That'd be my advice.
Joel, I love that you are always promoting community, local food, healthy food, ecological agriculture. Folks, if you would like to come hear Joel talk for a good amount of time next Monday night here in Chico, he'll be at Neighborhood Church. Tickets are on sale at Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, or you can go to Facebook and search for KZFR Chico, and the link is listed there, but I'm going to give it out over the air so everybody has it. It is salatinchico.eventbrite.com, and I'll spell that for you. It's salatinchico.eventbrite.com. If you have trouble with any of those three options, you can also call the farm, Chaffin Family Orchards, 530-533-1676. Again, this is next week, April 16th. It's going to be at 6 p.m. Doors open at 5, and we're going to get two fantastic hours of Joel talking about how to solve all the problems in the world, and I mean that literally.
Again, we've been talking with Joel Salatin, farmer, lecturer, founder and owner of Polyface Farm, and author of his new book, Folks, This Ain't Normal. He'll be here, yes, lecturing in Chico this coming Monday, April 16th. Again, thank you, Chris Kirsten, so very much. I want to, thank Chaffin Family Orchards and the Albrecht family as well. It's amazing what you guys do in our community. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
And thank you to Cheetah Chudy for stepping in for his parents to do Ecotopia. And Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR members and by Ed's Printing. Ed's Printing offers envelopes, business cards, newsletters, flyers, and carbonless forms. A variety of recycled paper is available. Ed's Printing is located at 550 Cherry Street in Chico. The telephone number is 891-4625. And by Alternative Energy Systems, a locally owned and operated partnership providing energy for life with sustainable energy, available on the web at www.solarenergyforlife.com. Alternative Energy Systems offers energy solutions for residential, commercial, and agricultural needs. They can be reached by calling 345-6980. And thank you, Joel Salatin.
Thank you for having me. It's been an honor.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, Cheetah, and thank you, Chris.
Thank you. Thank you.
I have one more announcement before I go. In January 2011, hundreds of people showed up at the Chico Masonic Hall to confront the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation about their plan to use the Tuscan Aquifer to supplement water transfers through the Sacramento Delta to Southern California. The great public opposition to the project set it on its heels, but it's back in a new envelope. If the water purveyors are allowed to proceed, our streams will run dry, our valley oaks will wither away, and the reservoirs will be drained to historic low levels. We need to turn out again to confront the water pirates on Thursday, April 12th, 6 p.m. at Chico Masonic Hall. Aqua Alliance is going to be there, and you can voice your views to attend this Glen Colusa Irrigation District meeting. Again, that's Thursday, April 12th from 6 to 8 p.m., Chico Masonic Hall, 1110 West East Avenue. Aqua Alliance is the advocate for the Tuscan Aquifer System and the 99% of Butte Basin citizens that rely on a balanced aquifer. The Aqua Alliance website has a headline article on their webpage, aquaalliance.net. Look for the headline, Integrating Groundwater into State Water Supply. This crucial meeting, again, coming up April 12th. Okay, and next is Storyteller with Adrian Scott. It's now 7 o'clock, and following Adrian Scott's Storyteller is All Mixed Up from 7:30 to 10 p.m. Thank you. It's 7 o'clock. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond.
Things like this can always take a little time. I always thought we'd be maybe together down the line. We start to fight and can't get over what was said. 'Cause you see black